today, it's the structure of the language and the way in which that leads to confusion that I'd like to talk about. The title of what I have to say today is Language, the Wily Servant. And I'd like to talk a little bit about how language serves us, but primarily about what a slippery thing it is and how it ends up, if we're not careful, controlling us. I think good writing and good speaking really has not so much to do with grammar and mechanics and proper rules as it does with a far more difficult and complicated and serious affair, and that is the use of words themselves, or the misuse of words, because nearly all of us, and in fact all of us, misuse words. Let's begin, since we're talking about words, by defining what a word is. What is a word? Okay, it's an expression of what? Can be an expression of your feeling. What else can it be? It's what? Okay, a tool of communication. How do words communicate? Okay, they are descriptions of something else. Very seldom is a word its own thing. It generally stands for something else. It's a symbol. A word is like money. The paper that a dollar bill is printed on is not worth anything. Back of it is hardly worth anything these days either, but nevertheless, we all agree that when I hand you this piece of paper, it's not the paper that you're receiving. Is the symbolic value of that piece of paper. And that's backed up somewhere else. And in a sense, every word is like that. The word death means nothing except as it communicates that thing made out of wood or metal behind it. Why do we use words? The answer to that is reasonably simple. It's so simple that I probably shouldn't have asked it. That is, it's difficult to go around pointing to the things or carrying the things around themselves. Jonathan Swift in Gulliver's Travels has a session where he visits the island where all the scientists are busy inventing super inventions like careless sheep and so forth. And he comes to a man who has done away with the problems that language creates by carrying around on his back all the things he wants to talk about, and then he pulls a chair out and a desk out, but it limits his conversation somewhat. He would have to point to the actual thing. Language, then, first of all, serves us by allowing us to carry on our back far more than we could literally carry in order to communicate the thing itself. So just like money, if you had to carry the actual currency around, or if you had to carry sheep and chicken around to trade, it would limit commerce, it would limit your ability to buy and sell. Money frees us in the same way that words free us. So language, then, is a servant. Emerson said, we are symbols as human beings. We are symbols and inhabit symbols. We live in a world, then, that essentially, because we reach it through language and learn it through language, is symbolic. It always represents something else. But look at what that does for us. To the Greeks, it is language that made us and makes us human. Unlike other animals, we can remember things when they are not present. Apparently, psychologists tell us that a dog, which you think eagerly awaits your arrival home, gets nervous about 4 o'clock when it comes to expect you, isn't really thinking of you at all. It's simply a trained behavior in the dog. The dog is not aware until you are actually present that it has missed you, and then it wags its tail and licks your hand. We can think about love even when objects of love are not there, and that's something, again, that animals cannot do, apparently. As a result of being able to carry things on our backs that aren't actually there and think about thoughts that aren't actually there, like love and friendship, progress is possible. We don't have to learn everything all over again the way animals do. And therefore, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. We don't have to think things all over again. We can go on from where previous generations have gone. Furthermore, we can do something that's vitally important to being human. We can abstract. we can talk about things and think things for which there are no actual objects. Love, patriotism, and the like. And that is really a great part of what it means to be human. Because we can abstract, we can also stand outside ourselves. We can imagine and think about our own death. We can put ourselves in other people's places. We can, in other words, as the Greeks recognized, be self-conscious. We can be aware of ourselves as people because we can stand outside ourselves. And that is indeed what it means to be human. We can appreciate nature in a way that a mouse and a deer who nature-naturing cannot do. We can stand back and miss it, enjoy it, hate it, love it. We can do all kinds of things that other animals can't do. And it is language which has freed us to do this. We can also pass that appreciation on. We can convince others of something that we have seen, even though they can't see it. And as a result, unlike a mouse or a deer, we can alter history. We can be ecological or non-ecological. We know that we are going to die in a way that other animals don't know. We are free to accept or reject God because we can also stand outside that relationship. Humans then have choices because language, in a sense, as their servant, has given them choices. But what I want to talk about today then is the price we pay for that. We can never again, once we have become self-conscious, know what it is like to be a part of nature in the way a deer must know it or a mouse must know it, to be one with the universe. Always our language keeps us at a distance. The price we pay, and I think symbolically you get the story of that in the book of Genesis, in the story of Adam and Eve, to know the taste of the fruit of knowledge of good and evil is to condemn yourself always to be outside the garden. And it's outside the garden that man is. Aware of what he's lost, some sense of what's missing, but and that is beautiful in and of itself, but nevertheless, he has lost it and he will never recover. It's difficult for us, in other words, to be natural. I get into discussions with my students sometimes about what being natural is. Is long hair natural or short hair or curly hair or shaving or not shaving? And the answer is there isn't any possibility for a human being of being natural. A deer can't help but be natural, but we simply can't be natural. We have choices of artificial systems because of the symbolic relationship that we have through language to the rest of the universe. We are symbols and inhabit symbols, and that always keeps us at a distance. So if we're free as a result of language, we are also very limited, and there are things we cannot do. Words confuse and and get in the way. They shoot us down. Now, why? In the first place, I tried to find, let me just give you an example. I tried to find an orange this morning so that I really could have an orange here, but I didn't find one. And an orange seems to work better than anything else. But assume that I have an orange here. Tell me what it tastes like. I have never tasted an orange. I've tasted any other taste you can possibly imagine, but I have not tasted an orange. Somebody want to? Like sugar water.
Exactly.
No, well, how's it different?
Well, it's got a fruit flavor.
Like apple?
No, like orange.
I don't... Okay, what does an orange taste like? Okay. If I were blindfolded, I couldn't tell the difference?
Yes, you could, because
the candy has it. But is the flavor the same?
No.
Not exactly. How is it different? So if I took a tangerine and added sugar, I would get orange?
No.
How about adding a tangerine and a grapefruit together? Would that give me orange? What would give me orange? Orange. If it is impossible for you to tell me, who have never experienced it, what the taste of an orange is, and then suddenly the minute I taste an orange, aren't all the words useless? Then I know what an orange tastes like. This particular metaphor I'm getting from Jonathan Edwards, whom I did my dissertation on, the Puritan preacher, who talked about how difficult it was. He didn't use orange, he used the taste of honey, but it would work the same. Any taste would work the same. How difficult it was, through the use of language, to tell people something they didn't already know. How can somebody understand angels or heaven or salvation if they haven't tasted it themselves? And he came to the conclusion then that preaching, in a sense, was virtually a useless activity, because through words, if you can't tell me something as simple as the taste of an orange, something I can concretely taste and look at, how then can you tell me about God and heaven and salvation? Aren't words essentially very, very powerless things? The only time orange is going to mean anything to me is if I have already experienced the orange. Words, it is important then, are not the things themselves. A word, the little scribbles on a piece of paper, D-E-S-K, are not the thing itself. And if that's true even of concrete objects, like desks and tables and tastes of orange, how much more true is it of love and patriotism and all of those abstractions that mean so much to our lives? It is important then to understand, I think, that in the English language, words have no, there's no clue in the word itself, in most of our English words, to what the word means. A person who did not know that D-E-S-K meant a table with drawers in it at which you sat and studied, there was no clue in the word itself. We do have a few words that sound like what they mean, whisper, bubble, and so forth, but by and large, the relationship is arbitrary and it has to be taught. So that words, then, it's important to understand in English, are not the things they represent. They don't look like the things or sound like the things. Some languages, Indian Sign Language, for instance, a person can read that with very little effort because the things look like what they're representing. A sun looks like a sun, a teepee looks like a teepee, and so forth. Some languages, let me just give you a couple of examples, claim that their languages are attempts to portray things. Here's a Hungarian word, O-L-L-O, that represents a common household object. What is it? Scissors. I didn't expect anybody to get that. Yeah, scissors. That's the Hungarian word for scissors because it looks like a scissor. Chinese originally started out to be a pictographic language in which the symbols were attempts to represent the thing itself. But here too, you can see the Chinese word for man or the characters for man vaguely look like a stick figure. But even there, if you were coming up against this pole, you would be hard put to guess that that was a man. And then what do you do when you come to something that, for which again in Chinese there isn't any object, heaven? Immediately, you're in a bit of trouble. But what the Chinese do is take the symbol for sky and the symbol for man and put it together. The symbol for sky exists. So that then becomes the Chinese symbol for heaven. Vaguely, much more than English, like what it represents, but nevertheless, not the same thing, not nearly the same thing at all. That's one of the primary reasons why in English, words just don't work very well. They're not the things that they represent. This is also why propaganda works and why so easily we can be led by the shape of the words and by the look of the words to do things that are absolutely senseless itself. Let me try an experiment with you. I'm going to try to propagandize you and brainwash you. And so I want you to understand that I am going to try to trick you. If you've heard this before, be quiet, because if it doesn't work, I'll appear foolish. And it will only make my point if you appear foolish. Okay, I'm going to try to get you to say something that is absolutely stupid, and that you know is stupid. Okay, because words are separate from things. okay, I need your response for this. This is, you may have come across this in a psychology class someplace. Let me say, a cigarette is called a smoke. Now, what I want you to do is say the smoke at the end. Okay, let's try that. A cigarette is called a... Okay, you got to do it with a little more vim and vigor. A cigarette is called a... Very good. Okay. A funny story is called a joke, right? A funny story is called a... Okay, now let's try those two. A cigarette is called a... A funny story is called a... Good. Okay. A hit in the mouth is called a poke. Okay. A hit in the mouth is called a... Okay, now let's try it. A cigarette is called a... A funny story is called a... A hit in the mouth is called a... The white of an egg is called a... Albumin. Notice that very quickly, in the heat, nobody told you that the last word had to rhyme. But what you have done is separate the sound of the word from the sense of the word and gone opted for the sound. In a much larger sense, that is exactly how propaganda works and how people, whole groups of people, whole nations can be made to say things, to do things, and to act in ways that in their right minds they would have absolutely no intention of doing. And you can wake up afterwards and say, why did that happen to me? Isn't this exactly why, for instance, the K sound, not the sound of the K, but that the K itself, why do you think it is that when you walk into a small, or drive into a small town looking for a coffee shop, instead of coffee shop, you'll have it spelled with a K, K-O-F-F-E-E, the Coffee Cup Cafe. You never see it spelled with a C. Same with cool, and with Kleenex, and so forth. And the same with the symbol of the Ku Klux Klan. Think for a minute about the Ku Klux Klan, what a silly name that is, but at the same time, look at how frightening the symbols are. What you're opting for, the frightening part of this, are those sharp, rigid lines in the cake. Suppose the Ku Klux Klan would have spelled it with three little limpy C's that lean over and don't go anyplace. It never would have gotten anyplace. Or suppose the swastika had been beautiful, curved like it, and suddenly it loses the fright of the line. Here, too, we are opting for the shape of the words, even the shape of a given letter, and that's getting to us rather than the sense of the word itself. The end result then, unless we are careful, and even if we are careful, is that words very quickly lose their symbolic value and become mere signs. We descend into cliché, and cliché is wrong. Those old trite expressions, high as a kite and busy as a bee and quiet as a mouse, a cliché is wrong. Not because it's grammatically wrong or not because it's just intrinsically bad writing. It's wrong because it isn't doing its job, because somehow we are letting somebody else do our thinking for us. The minute we look up at the clouds and see, oh, how fluffy the clouds are, because thousands of people have seen fluffy clouds before, we have been brainwashed and propagandized, and we have let somebody else do our thinking for us. But it's very, very easy to fall into that trap. So much so that we use clichés. I was talking to you this morning who just picked up a new one, Don't Upset the Apple Cart. Most of us have used that. Do you have any idea where that comes from or what it means? Very few of you, I suspect, do. How about ride roughshod over? How many of you really know what that means? Or to strike while the iron is hot? A few of you might guess that. But notice that every day, then, we use clichés, which not only don't work for anybody else, because we've heard them a million times and they just run like water off our backs, to use another cliché, but we ourselves don't even know what we're saying. They vaguely communicate. Don't upset the apple cart means, stay on the straight and narrow. And so notice how hard it is not to use clichés. How easy it is to fall into the trap of looking out somebody else's window at life and adopting their way of thinking.
Could I play devil's advocate?
Sure.
It seems possible that might serve in somewhat the same way for us as the invention of the wheel. It is a shortcut to a lot of things that we just don't have to bother working at to get us to another place.
What is it a shortcut to?
Well, instead of having to explain about, you know, if you can do that, you're going to cause this problem, things are going to be much more difficult than they are, you can just throw it up the and everybody sort of understands that something.
Okay, but just because everybody understands it, hasn't it for that very reason lost its effectiveness? When I hear it, I hadn't heard it for a long time till she used it this morning, and I got to thinking about what, you know, does that go back to the Depression? What does Don't Upset the Apple Cart go back to? And I'm not sure myself where it goes. So when I use it, shortcuts are good and bad. I mean, if it's a shortcut to get meaning across, then it's good. But if it's a shortcut to thinking for yourself what you really mean, then it's bad. I have my students go out and in an assignment and write five honest sentences. We had a Jesuit priest teaching in Augustana for a few years ago, for a couple of years after he retired from the priesthood and before he went to complete retirement back to the monastery. And he had the kind of wisdom that only a Jesuit priest with those years of training can amass. And he had boiled freshman English down, to use another cliche, into two words. Two rules, and only two rules did he use in his class. One, see what's there. And two, tell the truth. And a cliche, I think, is not seeing what's there, it's seeing what somebody else saw was there. And all of us get used to letting other people do our thinking for us. My students, when pushed to it, when I say you must go out and look at something and describe it the way you see it and not in the vague general terms that most of us communicate with, do just beautiful jobs of seeing what's there and telling the truth. So that, for instance, they will go out and instead of saying, we have a pathway in the middle of the campus that has a wood that goes through with it, instead of saying the slough path in autumn was full of beautiful colors, they will say the slough path yesterday looked like a box of melted crayons. It's a beautiful, new, fresh way of seeing things. It's the kind of thing that kids can do because they aren't in set and because they haven't begun yet to let somebody else do their thinking, that kids can do so beautifully that us adults find very difficult to do. An example was the last time we came to Holden, 5 years ago, we came up through Sheridan, Wyoming, and went down toward Yellowstone and came across the mountains where the switchbacks without guardrails were some of the most treacherous that we have ever gone through. And there in the front row were my wife and I talking about how, boy, doesn't this road twist and turn? Look at that switchback and so forth, using all the cliches and all the trite metaphors. And therefore, I suppose, seeing that mountain road in those old tired ways, and Gretchen, who at that time was 4 years old, was looking out at the same scene that we were looking at, and all of a sudden she said, wow, is this ever a scribbly road? And I turned to my wife and I said, you know, why couldn't I have thought of that? And the reason, I suppose, is that I've been propagandized and brainwashed and made uniform, and I, at that point, was letting language control me. Gretchen was controlling her own language, seeing things with the fresh eyes of a child. Exactly. Let me give you two examples of that. Sure, good writing is picture writing, is what you're saying, and it doesn't make any difference whether it's preaching or teaching or just communicating to each other. Not only is it picture writing, but those pictures somehow have to be fresh in order to make them vital. Emerson has a statement, I think, that's interesting. All language, Emerson said in his essay on poetry, all language is fossil poetry. All language is fossil poetry. Every word was once a poem. Now, what does he mean by that? He uses the word inspire. And I suppose if I were to have hand out pencils and so forth, most of you could define what it means to be inspired, turned on, and so forth. And you could find even other pictures for that. But notice that common word, which all of us use every day, for most of us, as Emerson said, is really a fossil of what it once was. Every word was once a poem, for Emerson, means that whoever first saw a relationship, saw a picture of something, and named it, made it fresh and new and unique. And then by the time it gets down to us, it's just purely an abstract word. What's the opposite of inspire? Expire. What does expire mean? To die. So that inspire is at the very opposite of what it means to cease or to die. Why is dying called expiring? Because it's breathing out. Inspire, therefore, is inspiration, literally a breathing in. And as Emerson points out, whoever first saw, and I hope all of you have had the experience of working with a geometry problem, to give my own particular bugaboo. If I hadn't cheated in fifth grade, I wouldn't be here in math. I wouldn't be here today. But if struggling with a problem or trying to make a breakthrough to understand something, and all of a sudden the light turns on and you see it, and notice that what happens involuntarily is that inward gasp of air. I see it. That is inspiration. Literally, it's a picture of the abstract thing. But by the time that symbol has come down to us, then, it has lost its punch, it has lost its effectiveness, it has lost its meaning. And good writing, good communicating, and good use of language, then, says Emerson, is trying to take that fossilized language in which most of us speak, these tired cliches and metaphors, the general vague language that most of us speak, and reattach the words to the thing. So that when we say heaven or God, the sense of it is really there. That's very difficult to do. If you're a preacher, you will understand that, or a teacher, or any kind of a communicator. It is very difficult to use words in that way. Very easy for children to do it. Very difficult for most of us to do it, because our language has started to control us. Let me give you a couple of examples of how, and I'm going to use E.E. Cummings, because he's been called by critics a master of the renewal of the cliché. Cummings has a way of taking a tired old sentence and using a word, putting a word in a different place in such a way that the whole thing becomes fresh and new again. Like you're taking an old coal in a fire and breaking it open, and all of a sudden it shines again. The first line of the Cummings poem that you see over in the store: I thank you, God, by putting a single word in the one place in a sentence where most of us would never think of putting it, this old sentence full of old words all of a sudden becomes new. I thank you, God, for most, this amazing day. Most of us would say, I thank you for this most amazing day, or I thank you most for this amazing day. But look at where it gets put, and all of a sudden, it's new again. I thank you, God, for most, this amazing day. The one about Cummings that I like the best is when he's talking about his mother and what her life meant to him. And he takes the most tired cliché and simply reverses it. My mother, he said, kept her sense of humor up to the very, and had he said end there, we never would have remembered that sentence. That's what's wrong. It may be a shorthand up to the very end, but it's not memorable, it's not fresh, and it's not new.